Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I have you loud and clear.
Hello.
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 Welcome.
Science.
And that is to say
physics. Medicine.
Nature.
Or space.
Time.
The brain.
Life.
The universe.
Hello, welcome to The Naked Scientists. I'm Phil Sansom, and this is the show where we bring you the latest breakthroughs in science, technology, and medicine. And this week, it's Q&A time. Coming up on the show, how gravity actually works, prehistoric dental issues, and breaking down the spread of the coronavirus.
The Naked Scientists podcast is powered by ukfast.co.uk.
But before we get into the questions, let's meet our panel. We've got Nadia Radsman, plant biologist, Chris Rogers, a physicist, Emma Pomeroy, bioarchaeologist, and Chris Smith, virologist. Let's start with Nadia. Hi, Nadia. Welcome.
Hello.
What have you brought in to show us today to start with?
I have a picture here of a part of a plant that I'm studying. This particular crop is actually a forgotten crop or underutilized, or another term for it is orphan crop, which is a crop that used to be consumed traditionally, in this case in Africa.
Would you like me to describe it for you? Because this looks like a bunch of roots, and some of the roots have got bulgy bits on them. So it's almost like a root has swollen up and become very fat. How big are these things, Nadia?
A little bit bigger than an apple, I would say.
Oh, they're quite large then. Can I hazard a guess? What do you reckon, Emma? What do you reckon those are?
They look a little bit like sweet potato or something like that.
Are they yams?
I was going to say potato, yeah. Is it yam or potato or something?
So it is tuber. So sweet potatoes and, I guess, yams, they are modified roots. However, this particular plant is in a legume family. So it's a completely different plant family than potatoes or even sweet potatoes. And it's called African yam bean.
And this is something that's been rediscovered and that you're looking to...
Yes. So because it's a forgotten crop, it's an orphan crop. It used to be consumed in Africa, but now only the rural areas are still growing them. Poor farmers actually grow them for security crops. But now I'm studying them because nothing is known about this particular plant.
A rediscovered crop. Awesome. Well, let's move on because next to Nadia, we've got Chris Rogers, who's a particle physicist. Hi, Chris.
Hi, so actually I'm an accelerator physicist. So that means I design particle accelerators. There's a subtle difference.
Well, what have you brought in to show us?
So in fact, what I've brought in is a little bit of a particle accelerator. So I'll show it to the other guests. It looks like a small black foil. So it's about the size of a very small playing card. And it's actually 1 micron thick. So about the same thickness as a bacterium. And it's actually how we get our beam into our particle accelerator.
What's it made of?
So it's made of carbon.
So that's an extremely thin sheet of carbon.
Extremely thin sheet of carbon.
What does that actually do?
So what we do when we want to get our beam of particles into our accelerator, it's really hard. So imagine when we start off with our particles, we just start off with a gas bottle with hydrogen gas. And we put a spark across that hydrogen gas and it makes ions come out. So we ionize the gas. We accelerate that beam up, and then we want to get it into a ring accelerator. If we put protons into that ring, then as the protons come back round to the start again, those protons would knock into each other, and we wouldn't really be able to get the protons into the ring properly. What we do is we accelerate a special sort of ion called an H-minus ion. So instead of having a proton, we have a proton with two electrons attached. When those H-minus ions go through this really thin foil, knocks those electrons off. And then we can bring those protons round in our ring.
So it's basically traffic management for particle accelerators.
That's exactly what it is.
Let's definitely come back to this area. But for now, we've got Emma Pomeroy, third in our panel. Emma, welcome. What have you brought? You're a bioarchaeologist, yes?
Yes, I am, yes. And I've brought with me a cast, so a replica of a Neanderthal skull, an individual that we know as Shanidar 1. So it comes from the site of Shanidar Cave in Iraqi Kurdistan, which is where I'm currently conducting excavations. But this chap was actually found back in the 1950s.
That's amazing. It looks very, very much like a human skull.
Yeah, and actually Neanderthals were pretty similar to us overall. If we look at the whole kind of span of the evolution of our species and our lineage, they're not so far away from us. They are sort of more robust in their brow ridges and in their face, and the middle of their face projects a bit more. Critically, they didn't have a chin. So one of our modern human characteristics is that we have a really prominent chin, and Neanderthals didn't. But other than that, they look pretty similar to us.
Can I just ask, when did they first appear?
Well, that's a good question. We see species that have some of their characteristics from about 450,000 years ago. So we think probably sort of about 300,000 years ago or perhaps a little more recently. So about the same time as modern humans did, actually.
So was there a sort of split in the evolutionary tree then? So there were our ancestors are both Neanderthals and anatomically modern humans like us, and they sort of went their separate ways, and there was a path that took them down the Neanderthal line and a path that became us.
Exactly. So if you imagine sort of going back before our direct ancestor and before the direct ancestor of Neanderthals, our ancestors before that actually diverged. So some of them moved out into Europe and eventually evolved into Neanderthals, and some of them stayed within Africa and eventually evolved into modern humans. And then after that, modern humans spread out into Europe and into Asia, and Neanderthals eventually went mostly extinct, apart from the little trace of DNA that many of us carry today.
Finally on our panel, we've got what should be quite a familiar voice to many of you listeners. This is Chris Smith, a virologist at Cambridge. Chris, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good.
How does it feel to be on the other side of the desk?
I'm pretty nervous because we're going to do the quiz, and I always take great delight in humiliating all the guests, and you've made me a panellist. And we should say the reason you made me a panellist is because, you know, the world is in the grip of what we're trying not to call a pandemic. So we thought it might be quite interesting for people to have the opportunity to ask some questions about this new coronavirus that's circulating, because I've been doing quite a bit of that. So I thought it would be very nice to help people if they want to ask anything about that.
Now's the time, actually. Let me just throw it to the other three of you. Do any of you have a perspective or a question that you want to share or ask Chris?
Emma?
We hear lots of advice about things we should and shouldn't be doing to avoid catching coronavirus and spreading it. So do face masks work? Do hand gels work?
Are you doing anything different?
Not really, because I'm always careful about washing my hands and that kind of thing, but should I be?
Is anyone in here doing anything different, Chris?
I had a cold on Friday, so work from home, but maybe that means you guys need to stay away from me.
Do you like the way he's come in and turned up at the studio, sat down opposite all of us, shaken all our hands, and now he's telling us he's got a cold?
I accidentally drank from Chris's water glass half a second ago, so, you know, there goes
that's
me.
It. We'll wait for you to cough later on.
Yeah, that's it for you. The answer to the face mask question is actually probably just save your money. So the face masks that are not the ones used in hospital are not effective. And that's for two reasons. One is that people tend to use them wrong. They put them on, take them off, put them on, take them off, touch all over them, for instance, when they want to eat and drink things. And that transfers virus particles from the surfaces they've been touching probably to the inside of the mask when they touch it. So it automatically brings the virus close to their face where they're trying to keep it away from. The other is that they quite quickly get damp because of the water in your breath. And this means that the particles of virus can pass through the gaps in the mask quite efficiently. And also, the masks don't have a very good stringency. There are big gaps between the fibres, which to the something on the scale of a virus, which is about 1/10,000th of a millimetre across, that's like the tunnel under the Thames. It's absolutely huge, so no obstacle whatsoever for the virus. They also don't tend to be worn properly. People leave big gaps around the sides. So when you breathe out or breathe in, it just pulls air in from the room into the side. So that's probably for masks. I would save your money. I've said to somebody, go and buy beer instead, because A, you'll enjoy having that in your mouth more than the mask. It'll probably cost you less based on the amount of profiteering that's going on at the moment, and it will give you equivalent, if not more, protection from the virus. It will also be more fun.
I feel good about my decision not to invest in any of this equipment. So thank you, Chris. Now, before we dive into the rest of the questions, and we will come back to many more coronavirus queries as well as others, for those of you at home, we've got a Guess Who quiz running throughout the show. Clues are coming up across the hour, so text or tweet us at Naked Scientists with your guesses. And here's your first clue, and it's a sound, and it's a sound that this creature makes. There we go. Did you catch that? We've got other clues coming later in the show. Any preliminary guesses? Any of you on the panel?
It sounds reptilian, Chris.
Is it an owl?
It is not an owl.
I have absolutely no idea at this stage. It sounded like a slightly injured duck or something to me. So,
I do love that guess. We'll give you more clues to put you all out of your misery. For now, let's move on to our first question. This is for you, Nadia, and this one has come in from Mel.
What's happening to a plant if you overwater it? And why don't hydroponic farms run into the same problem?
Let's start with the first part first. Watering plants too much. What's going on?
If you overwater a plant, what happens is that you would have this stagnant water around the soil, right? So this would create a waterlogging effect. In all plant tissues, you need to have access to oxygen. So if you have waterlogged plant, meaning that it couldn't access the oxygen anymore, this would create a low oxygen environment.
Well, how does hydroponics work then? Because you dangle the roots in water all the time,
yeah,
don't you?
So there are two types of hydroponics. So in large-scale hydroponics, what you have is the water is aerated, so you wouldn't have this low oxygen effects. Another one is a passive method where just a bit of the root actually touches the water. So the plant is still happy.
But otherwise, it seems like it's actually drowning. Because
it's not got enough oxygen. So, yeah. So what happens is if it's low oxygen, you cannot take up water inside the plant.
Well, I was going to say, what about plants that live in water?
So they have special modifications in their roots. And the tissues are called parenchyma. And they actually store, air to actually provide the oxygen to the plant.
Do they pump it there then? How does the air get into those bodies then?
I'm actually not sure about that.
I know that if you cut a water lily across, the stems have got a lot of hollow voids in the stems.
Yes, that is to actually provide the oxygen to the whole of the plant.
Wow. Well, thank you, Nadia. Let's move on to a physics question for you, Chris Rogers. And this one's from Tony, comes in via our web form. He asks, how does gravity work? Can you sum this up, perhaps?
So I have bad news. And the bad news is that no one really knows.
Oh, no.
I'm so sorry. But I can tell you what we do know. So in the 17th century, Newton and Hooke together figured out the laws of gravity, and they also figured out some things about force. So when we have a force, if we push something which is really heavy, we accelerate it a little bit, and if we push something that's really light, we accelerate it a lot. That was one of Newton's famous laws of physics. And then the law of gravity says that a really heavy body will attract things more than a really light body. Now, Einstein, he's a clever chap, right? So he came along...
I've heard that, yeah. He's got a good reputation.
He does, doesn't he? So he came along at the beginning of the 20th century, and what he said, he had a eureka moment where he actually thought, well, hang on, you've got these two different definitions of mass. One is that mass makes massive amounts of gravity, pulls things together really strongly. And the other one is that if you have a really massive object, it's really hard to push it. Well, what happens if we say that those two definitions of mass are actually the same? And so this is something called the equivalence principle. And so together with another principle which he had, the covariance principle, the principle that the laws of physics are the same no matter how quickly you're moving, he tied those together to make a new theory of gravity as a sort of curvature of space-time, because you can't tell whether it's just an acceleration or whether you're near to a gravitating body like a big planet or something like that.
I don't quite understand how you get to curved space-time.
Well, it's an interesting question. So if you imagine, for example, in a curved space-time...
I can't imagine that. I have no idea what that looks like.
Oh, yeah, you do.
Nadia?
Is it the same as getting closer and closer to the black hole and everything is distorted? Is that something?
Well, so if you walk around the Earth, that's like walking around a curved space-time. If you start at the equator and walk north, you end up at the North Pole, of course. It doesn't matter where on the equator you start, you will always end up at the North Pole. It's a curved space-time because parallel lines are no longer parallel.
People often use the analogy, Chris, of dropping a very heavy bowling ball on a trampoline, which distorts the trampoline down, bends the trampoline downwards. And if you were to roll a ball across the trampoline, it would roll down a hill. And they're saying that is a two-dimensional manifestation of the curvature of space-time. If you imagine space being the fabric that's the surface of that trampoline, is that a reasonable approximation?
It's a lovely analogy, actually. So it's exactly right. And it does show how space-time can be curved.
So curving space-time, is that what we're left with?
So some theorists come along. They say that we have potentially a sort of subatomic particle called a graviton. gravitons are really hard to see because gravity is what we think of as being a very weak force. But there's another more fundamental problem. If we put these gravitons into our theories, it turns out that the gravitons don't work in the theories, that you get infinite forces going around, which obviously isn't physical. So until we do observe a graviton, it's only a theory.
Gravitons, curved space-time. What a complicated subject. Thank you, Chris.
Hello, I'm Chris Berrow, bringing you a brand new podcast called Naked Gaming. This is where we look at gaming news.
If you want to take it to someone else's house, you have to buy an add-on into your subscription service outside of your property.
Not as simple as you might think.
Exactly that.
Reviews.
So I'm at a spot on the map where horses are supposed to be, but I'm not having much luck at the moment.
And we also go back in time with Retro Revival.
I've got to a bit with some scarecrows, and it's actually quite tough, really. And this used to be quite an easy game that you just pick up and play.
Download Naked Gaming wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, we have a panel of experts taking on your science questions. So if there's anything you've always wanted to know for a show like this, give us a try and email chris@nakedscientists.com or tweet @nakedscientists. Still to come, solar storms, farming using fungi, and our panel goes head-to-head for the Naked Scientists quiz. But for now, here's the next part of our Guess Who game. First, we heard the noise that our creature makes. Take another listen. Now it's time for clue number two, and here's the clue. There are about 1,000 species in this creature's family, and they live all over the world, from the Americas to Africa, Australia, much of Asia, and areas of Southern Europe. Any ideas?
Still stuck.
All right, well, mull that one over, and let's move on. Emma, over to you with this next question from Adam.
Were people tens of thousands of years ago really that different to us now?
That's a great question. So if we're talking about modern humans, so our own species, we've been around for about 300,000 years. And actually, for much of that time, we were hunter-gatherers. And so some of the characteristics that our ancestors would have had would be that they were much more active than us. So their bones were actually rather stronger than ours because our bone strength depends on how active we are during our life. We imagine that people in the past were much shorter, right? And that we're taller today. But actually, that's probably not the case. Up until about 10,000 years ago, people were similar in height, actually, certainly in Europe, to what we are today. Partly because their nutrition was good, but they didn't have the disease burden that we have. And that really comes about with agriculture and settling down.
Did you see that paper, Emma, that came out of the US by looking at hundreds of years worth of medical records and found that our temperatures today are a bit lower?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely fascinating research. And I think it sort of fits in with the pattern. So maybe tens of thousands of years ago, people were not much shorter. But if we go back a few hundred years, people were substantially shorter. And perhaps one of the things that was using up the energy that they had was fighting off infections and having this higher body temperature all the time. So super interesting.
Have the changes been genetic or have they been environmental?
The answer to that is possibly a bit of both. It's very hard. So with things like stature, it's very hard because it's determined by many different genes, hundreds even. We find it hard to actually track how that's changed, but some recent work is suggesting that actually the genetics of height has changed. But things like height and the robusticity of our skeleton, so how strong our skeleton is, have a big environmental component to them as well.
Nadia?
If we are quite different than our ancestors, how relevant is the paleo diet?
That's a really interesting question. So I think from our perspective as sort of evolutionary biologists, the paleo diet's not really something that ever existed. So human populations have lived all over the world with all kinds of different diets as hunter-gatherers. Yeah. And there's no one diet that we can say this is what we ought to be eating. Mm. So, yeah, unfortunately, the paleo diet's not really a very convincing argument.
Goodness. Okay, a relief at least. Now, Chris Smith, we've had a coronavirus question come in from Lorna here in the UK. She says she's about to start FECT chemo, which is a combination of drugs for breast cancer. And she's very concerned about losing her immune system with the spread of the coronavirus.
Do you think she should postpone? And for context, she's 74, otherwise fit and healthy.
The answer to this is, at the moment, the risk of coronavirus in the population is low. So the chances of you encountering it is low. But you're right to be concerned, because people who are at greater risk are those whose immune system doesn't work as well as someone who's got a fully functioning immune system. And the way chemotherapy drugs work, not exclusively, but some of them, is to switch off the way cells divide, and that includes your immune system. So it can cause the immune system to stop working quite as well. Now, the risk placed to your health from breast cancer is almost certainly at the moment going to be higher than the risk posed by coronavirus infection. Now, what you could do if you are concerned about this is to do two things. If you need to go to clinic appointments, then everyone who's going to a clinic appointment should, if they have any symptoms whatsoever of any kind of infection, as a courtesy, should phone the clinic and warn them, because that means the clinic could see that person at the end of the list and they don't then sit in a waiting room full of people who don't have the infection and give it to them. So if we all do that, and we can all rely on people to do that, then it means that you're not at risk going to, say, clinic appointments. And the same goes for your general practice. At the same time, you may think, well, I don't feel comfortable going out into mass gatherings and things while I'm at higher risk. And the same would apply for any kind of viral infection, whether it's flu or just the common cold, because all of these things will provoke a more intense infection in a person who's taking drugs like these ones, which will suppress the immune system for a while. Under those circumstances, you might say, well, I'm going to just use a common sense approach and I'm going to keep myself away from people who obviously have symptoms. I'm going to warn my friends and family, look, if you've got some kind of symptoms or you're not feeling very well, don't come over while you've got them. Don't come and see me. Wait until you're feeling better. And at the same time, don't go out to various places where there will be lots of people who you can't warn in advance. And then once you're over your course of chemotherapy and hopefully you're all better, everything should come back to normal and the risk will have passed and you'll be fine again.
Great stuff. Lorna, I hope that helps you out. And let's move on to plants again, because Nadia Grant sent us a message saying, why do plants like warmer soil? And I hadn't heard of this because I'm not a gardener. Can you explain?
Warmer soil is important for two things. One is for growth and nutrient uptake. So low soil temperature would actually increase water viscosity and also reduces the root permeability to uptake the water. This would then affect nutrient uptake, because that is like part of the root to shoot transport through xylem that needs water. So this would pretty much affect the plant growth. Another one is for germination, but this is a little bit tricky because the seeds actually need to have low temperature period to break dormancy. And then when it's in warmer temperature, when you can actually tell from winter to spring, it starts to germinate in warmer soil.
So is it part that water and nutrients, those flow more easily, and part that it just triggers the seed germination itself?
Yeah, actually the breaking of dormancy is because of the low temperature during wintertime. There are two different hormones that are regulating this. So one is abscisic acid, and this pretty much it inhibits germination. And the other one is gibberellic acid, and this promotes germination. And during the low temperature in winter, you have increased gibberellic acid and reduce abscisic acid, and this break the dormancy. So then when spring comes, it can grow.
Chris Smith?
Nadia, it's an extreme of temperature, but heat from fire and the products of burning can also stimulate some seeds to grow, can't they? Because a friend of mine in Australia actually used to discover what some of these molecules are by burning bits of tissue paper, and they're getting the molecules out and showing they would make some seeds germinate. How does that work?
So actually, there is a particle from smoke called carrakin, and this is actually a plant hormone. So this actually comes from smoke, and this is also partly why some seeds would actually start to germinate after the fire.
Why would the seeds want to do that? Why is it beneficial to the plant to grow after a fire?
It's part of the cycle of the forest itself. Some forests, like for example in Australia, actually need this particular cycle.
Nadia, thanks very much. Chris Rogers, we've had a physics one come in for you, and this one is from Katie.
What makes up a solar storm?
Solar storm is a really interesting phenomenon. It's to do with space weather. What we see on Earth is we see the magnetic field of the Earth actually changes, and we see a really fantastic light display with the aurora. And what's going on is charged particles are flying from the sun towards the Earth, and bashing into the Earth. So you get this charged plasma, and that actually physically changes the Earth's magnetic field.
What are those particles?
Typically, they're protons or ions or electrons. So the sun is mostly made up of hydrogen with a bit of helium mixed in. And so typically, you're getting ions from that hydrogen and helium and electrons associated with those ions.
What are the effects of this when you've got all these particles bashing into the Earth and its atmosphere?
So if it's a small solar storm, then you see a really bright aurora. So the whole sky lights up in the far north. With a really bright solar storm, you can get amazing effects. So there's a famous event in the 19th century called the Carrington event, where just at the beginning of the invention of electricity, they had telegraph wires. The telegraph wires would actually spark out. You get these really big sparks coming from the telegraph wires.
Can the Earth gain mass that way? And the reason for asking you, Chris, is that Steve Rampley has just pinged us an email and said, is the mass of the Earth changing? Is one way that the Earth's mass can change from particles coming in from outer space?
That's an interesting question. I don't know whether the Earth's mass can change, but I do know that the sun's mass can change. So the sun is slowly losing mass as it fires off all of these high-energy particles. Those particles are flying out into the intergalactic medium, and so the sun itself is losing mass.
Is it not also losing mass because it's sending energy to us in the form of light, and that light must have come from a process that consumed mass in the sun in order to produce the energy that it radiated at us in the first place. So that would also lose mass for that reason, wouldn't it?
That's a really good point. So, of course, Einstein tells us, again, that clever guy, he tells us that mass and energy are interchangeable. So when hydrogen fusion happens, hydrogen fuses into helium, and the mass of the helium is lower than the mass of the hydrogen.
Chris, thank you. Moving on now, Emma, here's one for you. Did people have tooth problems thousands of years ago before any dentists ever existed?
Yeah, they did. I mean, if we think about the kind of tooth problems we have today, we associate them with eating too much sugar. So we get things like cavities and we have to get them filled. And while people didn't get them as much in the past, before we had like refined sugar and foods like that, they did still have these problems. And we can see evidence of tooth problems actually going right back to dinosaurs, but certainly in people. And it depends what they ate in part. So even some hunter-gatherers who we think are eating a very kind of healthy diet with not much sugar in it, in some populations where they actually relied more on sugary fruits, for example, they could have actually really high rates of cavities that were similar, in fact, to some modern populations today who do eat refined sugar.
And you sort of just have to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, before dentists, it would have been a bit of a nightmare, I think. We do see that there were attempts actually to try and treat cavities in the teeth or damage to the teeth. We've got examples that go back as far as kind of 14, 15,000 years. And with those, they were using things like bitumen to try and fill holes and bits of hair and things like that.
That sounds horribly painful.
Yeah, it doesn't sound good. There's one from about 6,000 years ago where they've tried to fill a crack in the tooth with beeswax, and that sounds a little bit nicer to me. But going back much further, we can actually see what we call interproximal grooves. So these are grooves between the teeth where individuals have actually been sticking, say, sticks or feathers or something between the teeth, presumably to try and relieve pain. And they've been doing that so much, it's actually gouged out a groove in the tooth.
Was it not just toothpicking? They were trying to dislodge bits of meat and other muck from between their teeth.
But it tends to be between particular pairs of teeth, and that suggests that it's a chronic issue with those particular teeth. Either that or it's just an idiosyncratic behaviour, so someone's individual kind of habits. But in some cases, there is one Neanderthal example where we can actually see that they had periodontitis, so inflammation of the gums, and they may well have been doing that to try and alleviate some of the pain and discomfort associated with.
So you could see the decay there alongside the evidence of the scraping.
Yeah, so in that case, what you can see is that actually the bone that holds the teeth in has started to recede back in response to that infection of the gums. But we don't see that in all cases. So maybe sometimes it was just people sitting and picking away at their teeth out of boredom or something.
All makes you grateful for dentists today, doesn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. That's what I always say to our students when we're doing practicals.
Thank you, Emma. And let's move on. Chris Smith, we've had a question in another coronavirus one. This is from listener Paul.
If some infections of the coronavirus are termed mild, does that mean those victims are young or middle-aged and can or have developed antibodies?
Is Paul right?
It's certainly true that if we look at the data And we're looking at data at the moment from largely China, because obviously they're ahead of the world in the numbers of cases they've had and their collection of the data. This will probably become clearer as other countries, certainly Italy, for example, which is having a lot of coronavirus cases, and the UK too, we're going to join the party and contribute our own data. At the moment, there are very few children there who have had this infection or have had severe outcomes from this infection or who have died from this infection. The vast majority of the cases have been in older people. The vast majority of the fatal cases have been in very old people. And it looks like men are disproportionately likely to die compared with women, although it's an equal opportunities virus. It seems to infect both men and women equally. Now, why is it then that the children appear to be not getting it? Well, actually, what I think is happening, and we have to speculate because we don't know for sure yet, this will become clearer, but what I think is probably going on is that the children are not getting overt symptoms, so they're not getting tested, so they're not registering in the data as having had this infection, but they have had it, they've had it in a very mild way. And a bit similar is chickenpox. If you think about it, when we catch chickenpox as kids, and in countries like the UK, 90% of us have had chickenpox. Most of us catch it within the first few years of our lives. And we'll get two or three spots, maybe a few more than that, but we get a very mild infection. If you're unlucky enough to catch chickenpox when you're older, you tend to get a much more severe infection. And there are lots of viruses which do produce a more serious manifestation the older you get. So it may well be that in this case, it's doing the same sort of thing, and that children are catching it, they're getting very trivial symptoms, and we're not regarding this as, oh, they've got this coronavirus, they're not being tested, so they're escaping from scrutiny, and it's giving us the false impression that they're either not being infected or they're immune. As far as we know, no one is immune to this virus yet because it's new, so no one's seen it before, no one has immunity, and that's why it has the potential to spread across the entire world population.
Chris, thank you.
The Naked Scientists podcast is produced in association with Spitfire, cost-effective voice, internet and IP engineering services for UK businesses. Find out how Spitfire can empower your company at spitfire.co.uk.
Music in the programme is sponsored by Epidemic Sound, perfect music for audio and video productions.
Today, I'm joined by a panel of experts ready to take on your science questions. We've got plants pro Nadia Radsman, physics prodigy Chris Rogers, ancient bones aficionado Emma Pomeroy, and virtuoso virologist Chris Smith. And we have a question for you at home. We've got a game of Guess Who running throughout the show. First, we heard the noise. Let's have a reminder. And your third clue: it can range in size from as small as a ball bearing to as large as a dinner plate and comes in almost every colour. Panel, what do we think?
What was the second clue again?
The second clue: there are about 1,000 species in the family and it lives all over the world, Americas, Africa, Australia, much of Asia and areas of Southern Europe.
And it's the dinner plate size?
Anything from a dinner plate to a ball bearing.
Is it the same dimensions as a dinner plate?
Not necessarily.
Wow, you any ideas about him?
No, I feel more confused rather than any closer to knowing.
It makes that kind of noise.
Nadia?
What part of the animal is making the noise?
It's the mouth.
It is the mouth.
It's
okay.
The mouth. I think we should leave it there because we've got a final clue coming up in this particularly fiendish game of Guess Who later on the show. But for now, it's quiz time. It's the part of the show that you've all been waiting for, and our panelists are going to compete for the prize beyond price. That's to be awarded Naked Scientists Big Brains of the Month. We're going to divide you into Team 1, that's Nadia and Chris Rogers, and you're going to be facing off against Team 2, that's you, Emma, and Chris Smith. And I hope you're ready, because it's time for Round 1. This round is called Count 'em Up. Okay, Team 1, here's question 1. Which do you think there are more of? Transistors in the world's largest supercomputer or bacteria in the average human body?
So I can help you with supercomputers because I know it's an exaflop machine. The two exaflops I think they have on the cards at the moment. But I can't help with bacteria.
There are a lot of bacteria. I think a portion of the weight of human body is like considerably consists of the bacteria mass. I would say bacteria, but I'm not really sure.
What do you think? I'm going to have to press you.
I'm going to let Nadia suffer.
I'm not sure.
Because if Nadia chooses, then I can blame her afterwards.
And because bacteria divides very, very fast, I would say.
So are you saying bacteria?
Yeah, well, transistor cannot divide, right?
That is incorrect. Yes, the answer is transistors because the most recent estimates for bacteria in the human body put the number of cells in there as about 30 trillion. But the world's biggest supercomputer, Summit, it belongs to the US Department of Energy, and it's about 74 trillion transistors, and that's the size of two basketball courts. Let's move over to team two. That's you, Emma, and Chris Smith. So question number two, which are there more of? Birds in the sky, I should say birds in the world, that's just a poetic way of saying it, or neurons in the average human brain?
Wow,
that's tough.
100 billion nerve cells in the average human brain.
I couldn't even begin to guess how many birds there are, but I would go for birds, but I'm not quite
sure. Are there more than 100 billion birds on Earth? It's quite high.
It is quite a lot.
There's 7.7 billion humans.
True, but then birds can be much smaller, can't they?
Yeah. So are we saying that birds are about 10 times more numerous than humans? That seems pretty plausible, actually.
It is plausible, but I'm not sure if it's right, which is the
question. Are you going to go with it?
What should we go with then?
Oh, I don't know.
Birds?
Yeah, let's
do birds.
That is correct.
Put it there. Look at that. We're off for a flying start.
Fist bump.
My reputation's intact so far.
Good job. So the last estimate was actually two decades ago for number of birds. It put it between 200 and 400 billion. So big bounds, because birds are very hard to estimate. Likely it's gone down, but the human brain is about 100 billion. On average, it's actually 86 billion. And the estimates for decline, the biggest estimate we've got is 30% since 1970. So
brain cells or the average human intellect.
Birds in the world. So we can be pretty sure that it hasn't gone down by enough to go below the number of neurons. So birds wins. All right, as we enter round two, team two, you're on one. Team one, you're on nil. So it's everything to play for as we move back to team one. And this round is called Soft Spot. So question one. Which animal, which lives in the bitter cold in the Andes Mountains, has what's considered to be the softest fur in the world?
Do you know any animals which live in the Andes?
Chris Smith, you seem pretty keen. Do you know the answer?
I reckon I do, but it's not my go, is it?
No.
Do I get a bonus point?
Not at all.
Is it
llama?
Llama. Llama, yeah, bring it on, llama.
I'm not sure, but...
Are you saying llama?
I think llamas. I'll say llama. I'll take the fall this time, though.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that's not right.
Is it a chinchilla?
It is indeed a chinchilla.
Yeah.
Well done, other Chris. I'm sorry, Nadia. I gave you the wrong Chris for this round. So my apologies. But here it is. This is a chinchilla. Here's a picture of one.
They are really fluffy.
It's a tiny rodent. It's got each follicle has at least 50 tiny little hairs sprouting from it. And it's actually so soft and fluffy, it can't bathe in water because it won't dry quickly enough and it'll get bacteria and fungus. So it actually has to bathe in dust. So very cool animal, that. Right. Team two, what mineral defines a number two on the Mohs hardness scale? The lowest defining mineral that you can actually scratch with your fingernail. And as a hint, it's widely used as a fertilizer.
Well, talc is right at the bottom of the scale and diamond's right at the top.
Right.
So what's two? And you're saying the mineral can be scratched, this Mohs scale two can be scratched with your fingernail.
Number three, the mineral for that cannot, but number two is the highest one that can.
And we use it as a fertilizer.
Yeah.
So that's going to be something with phosphorus in it then.
I guess so, but...
Calcium phosphate?
I can't come up with a better phosphate. Guess.
Calcium,
let's go with calcium.
Well, that's bone though. That's quite odd.
Yeah.
I'm going to need an answer
sodium
or a pass.
Sodium phosphate.
I'm afraid that's not correct. I'm sorry, the correct answer was actually very close in formula. It's calcium sulfate dihydrate, which is gypsum.
Yeah.
If you've heard of that one.
Yeah, gypsum.
Yeah, yeah. Gypsum, yeah.
It's also plaster of Paris, isn't it?
It's plaster. Right. And it's in chalk and drywall and all that stuff.
That's sort of what I was going for. I got sidetracked. Where does the fertilizer bit come from then? Because
it is used as a fertilizer. I mean, it's, you know,
might challenge
gypsum
that one.
Well, it's still 1-0 as we go into the third round. And this is a particularly fiendish round. So if you weren't ready, now is the time. This round is called Weird Weather. All right. So team number one. What I'm going to do for both of you is describe the conditions required for a particular weather phenomenon. And I want you to tell me what that phenomenon is. Okay, so what weather phenomenon occurs under the following conditions? First, a strong electric field in the atmosphere, usually from a thunderstorm or volcanic eruption. Two, that field gets concentrated around a curved object, like the tip of a ship's mast. And three, the air around this area ionizes and turns to plasma. What weather phenomenon?
Got to be lightning, right? Does it need to be a specific sort of lightning?
I can't possibly comment.
So there's famous St. Elmo's fire, which is a famous sort of lightning which is associated with ship's masts.
I would go with Chris' answer because, yeah, it's something got to do with plasma, electricity charge.
What do you think? Is that your answer?
It's in Elmo's fire.
That is correct. Yes, I possibly shouldn't have given that with the physicists on this team. So you've got the right Chris this time. But yes, St. Elmo's fire. What it is a corona discharge around a pointed object. And it works on airplane nose cones as well. And back in the day, it was considered a religious phenomenon. Actually, a good omen by many sailors. Team two, this is question number two. This is try and get your lead back. What weather phenomenon occurs under the following conditions? Number one, dark thunderclouds. Number two, either a heavy downpour or a rainstorm with nearly uniform-sized droplets. And three, the sun breaks through those dark clouds and projects against them.
Oh, it's got to be a rainbow, right?
I mean, but it seems too obvious, but it can only be.
It's got to be a rainbow.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah, I think we say that.
I have to say, that's half a point for that. So you can get your correct answer jingle, I think. But the full correct answer would have been a triple or tertiary rainbow, which is quite a rare weather phenomenon. So I haven't made it easy for you. But what that is actually a rainbow that's projected onto the side of the sky where the sun already is. And so you need those dark clouds next to the sun. Otherwise, you just can't see it. There's not enough contrast. But it does exist. There's several that have been cited. It's very, very cool.
So do we get half a mark for
that? So you get half a mark, and that puts you in the lead.
So that gives us Big Brain of the Week award, then.
Team two, you are Big Brains of the Week.
Do we get a round of applause?
Come on.
Just about scraped to win.
Oh, that was lucky. Reputation intact.
Right. Now, moving back to the questions, here's one for you, Nadia. And this comes from user Hayseed on our forum. He's asking about underground fungal relationships with plants. He says they seem to be key to plants thriving. What are they, and could they be a new model for farming?
This particular fungus, we call it Arbuscular mycorrhiza fungus. Actually, a lot of plants can associate with this fungus. More than 80% of land plants could have mutualistic symbiosis with this fungus. So it's a win-win situation. So what happens is that if there is low phosphate in the soil, the plants would then engage in this mutualistic symbiosis with the fungus. And because the fungus has this extensive network of mycelium in the soil, it can actually forage the soil for more phosphate and then transfer it to the plant.
What's a mycelium?
So mycelium is this thread-like extension of the fungus, and it finds where the phosphate patches that the plants couldn't find and then transfer it to the plant. And then in return, the plant would actually give the carbon nutrient in forms of lipids back to the fungus.
Why can't plants do that themselves, though, find that particular phosphate?
Sometimes there is this depletion zone around the root. This is because it will take up a lot of the phosphate around it. But then there's also this particular thing where phosphate usually actually just stay in the topsoil. So obviously, because the root is going down, it cannot access something that's really high up, right? So with the fungus, it can actually help that.
They're almost acting like root extensions then, trying to seek out phosphates that the plant can't get to.
Exactly, yeah. So mycorrhizal fungus, this association was actually back 400 million years ago. It's a very ancient symbiosis. And this is even before the land plants actually acquired roots. So it actually helped the plants to gain the nutrients that it needs.
Chris Smith, did you have a question there?
No, I was just going to say, I like your root extension. I began to think about hair extensions, and it's like it is the plant equivalent of hair extensions.
We don't use fungi for hair extensions.
It enormously increases the collecting area of the plant. And the amazing thing about all this, because I first encountered this about 20 years ago, I began to read about it, and it's this whole barter economy, because the fungus and the plant are trading. I'll give you some nutrient in return for some other. Mm-hmm. But actually, if the fungus tries to rip off the tree, then the tree can actually decide it's not going to trade with that fungus anymore. And they can be stingy, can't they? So it's a really clever sort of relationship.
Yes, a lot of symbiosis are like that. They're very quite stingy.
What about the second part of this question, though? Are these fungal relationships something that's important for farming?
So it would clearly help the farming system in a way that will make it more sustainable. Because if we think of this fungus helping the plant to acquire more phosphate when there is low phosphate around, you can have reduced usage of phosphate fertilizers. And also, What's interesting is that a couple of studies also shown that having this fungus around would increase the drought tolerance of this plant, and it will also increase the resistance to diseases.
Is this something that farmers are currently taking into account?
Not exactly, because if we think of, there are also pathogenic fungus around.
What does that mean, pathogenic?
Induce diseases to plants.
So bad fungus as opposed to the good fungus.
Yes, that's bad fungus.
I see.
And Arbuscular mycorrhiza is the good guys. So obviously to deter this bad fungus, the farmers would spray a lot of the crops with fungicide. And if it's a broad spectrum fungicide, what happens is that it will also kill the good guys in the soil. So to prevent that from happening, what farmers could do is actually to use very specific fungicide for a particular pathogenic fungus, the bad guy, that is affecting the plant, but only in the leaves. And so the good guys, the good fungus, could thrive in the soil.
Nadia, given how important these fungi are, is there any way that a plant has got to make sure that its offspring get the same beneficial fungus?
Right, not exactly. So, as I've mentioned before, this particular fungus is called Arbuscular mycorrhizal fungus. There's another type of fungus, which is called endomycorrhizal fungi. It actually associates with some orchids. So with that, this is very interesting because some orchids would actually need a particular fungus for it to germinate. So what happens is that the seed of the orchid needs to be associated with a very specific fungus, and then it would eat up the fungus for it to then grow and germinate.
A fungus specifically for that one plant. I guess this must be a whole world of different possible relationships.
Yeah, so that's why some orchids cannot be grown outside of its habitat, because it needs that fungus to grow.
Chris Rogers?
I've heard before that different plants can talk through fungi, that they can pass chemicals between different plants. Is that true?
It is, yeah. So it's pretty much a hidden network of massive threads under the soil, right? And the way they knew about this is that a particular tree was fed with radioactive isotope of carbon. It doesn't occur in nature, so we can trace this, right? And they could actually trace it very, very far away from that one particular tree. So it means that there must be some sort of communication, the network under the soil, the hidden network through the fungus.
So the interpretation is that the radioactive carbon goes into tree number one, let's call it.
Yep.
It then trades with this fungus that's
exactly
around its roots, yep, which then carts off that particular chemical and then delivers it or deposits it or trades it with another tree miles away, and that's how the radioactivity gets spread.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Nadia, thank you so much. This week, we're putting your science questions to our panel of people, Nadia Radsman, Chris Rogers, Emma Pomeroy, and Chris Smith. But before we get on to more questions, it's now time for the fourth and final clue for Guess Who. First, we heard a noise. Let's have a reminder of that. Then we heard that there are about 1,000 species in the family living all over the world. Then we heard they can range in size from bowl-bearing to as large as a dinner plate and come in almost every colour. And our final clue, they mainly eat large insects, although they've been known to chow down on lizards, mice, bats, birds, and even snakes. What do we think? Anyone at home? Anyone in the studio?
Does the name of it begin with an M?
It does not.
Hmm.
Chris Rogers?
Is it a spider?
It is perhaps a spider. I'll need more than that.
Tarantula.
It could well be a tarantula. You've got it. Well done, Chris.
What is it then? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's tarantulas. It's the family. They live all over the world.
But that noise, what is
that? Oh, that's its mouth parts moving and hissing. They hiss when they get into the aggressive pose. It's really incredible.
My goodness.
There you go. So well done, Chris.
Do I get an extra point in the quiz?
I think he deserves one. I wouldn't have guessed that.
I think so. I wonder if it's too late to retroactively change the result. Probably is, but congratulations to you. Very well done.
Do you want to... Let's put a smile on Chris's face now.
Well, let's move on with the questions. Chris Smith, we've got a question for you on COVID-19. Listener Ken asks, how can elderly people be better protected in our communities where the virus has not yet become established? Do we need much greater preventative efforts by limiting mass attendance events, like Ken's local Cheltenham Festival here in the UK?
Right. First of all, are elderly people at greater risk? And the answer is that they're at greater risk of complications from this. They're not at greater risk of catching it than anybody else. Everyone's at risk of catching it because no one has immunity. And depending upon how sociable you want to be, your risk is going to go up.
But Ken's point is that these are the people that are most concerned. These are the people that are most vulnerable.
Yeah. And so what one has to consider is, I know what my risk is, therefore. If I'm older, I'm at a higher risk. If I'm younger, I'm at a lower risk. And I can make a judgment about whether or not I want to do anything about that. If I decide I want to do something about that, there are some simple practical things you can do. If you live on your own, or, you know, just with a partner, then it may be possible to adjust your lifestyle. I was talking to one person the other day who said that what she and her husband have taken to doing, because he's at higher risk, is that they will go and do their weekly shop in the evening when they know the shop has fewer people in it. So they're going to bump into fewer members of the public who might be incubating this. That's one thing. Two, you can tell your relatives and your friends to please let you know that they've got a cold or a cough or something before they come over. And in that way, you can choose whether or not you want to socialise with people who might be able to infect you with something. And if everyone begins to use their common sense like this, don't go and see each other, don't take the grandchildren over when you've got some symptoms, because it's a fact that with any kind of infectious disease, the more symptomatic you are, the more infectious you are.
But is there not any argument for containment by limiting these huge events so that it doesn't get into, for example, the town of Cheltenham where Ken might live?
There is an argument for doing that, and that's what Italy are trying to do as a huge experiment at the moment. Their approach has been to say, we're going to shut schools for 10 days, we're going to shut universities for 10 days. They've chosen those groups because, A, they've got large groups of individuals who are young individuals who fall into this category of potentially getting infected but not actually knowing they potentially are infected with this virus and therefore being able to pass it on to other people. Those children also amount to a large group who could pass it into their parents, who could take it into the workplace, for example. So by reducing activity in those areas of society, they're doing the experiment to see, right, what's that going to do to the spread of this thing? Is it going to slow it down? At the same time, they're effectively putting a huge chunk of their country into quarantine, again, to stop movements and slow down the rate at which this trickles across the population, because there's no going back now. There's no way we're going to stop this. We all accept that it is going to spread, and it's going to basically spread to everybody eventually. But it's the rate at which it does that that matters. And if you can slow down the rate at which it's going across a country and through a population, you can smooth out the spikes. Because the danger here is if you get lots of people who get infected all at once, the small minority that will have a problem if there are not healthcare services available, because there are so many of them coming all at once, there's a danger that you then get a knock-on effect on the health service. And then you also get a secondary knock-on effect because, say, if the ambulances are not available for someone with a heart attack because they're dealing with all these people with, say, a coronavirus infection, then people start dying of heart attacks. So that's what people are trying to do by doing these sorts of manoeuvres. But we've never been in this position, so we just don't know. So it's very hard to say this is the way to deal with this, because at the moment, we're learning.
So if it were up to you, what would you say? Keep the Cheltenham Festival, maybe try and call it off, or too early to say?
For now, too early to say, because we don't know what the numbers are going to be. We don't know what the level of circulation in the population is at the moment or henceforth. And therefore, because we don't know the trajectory, we don't know how many of these measures we're going to have to resort to try and slow this thing down.
Chris Rogers?
Is there a risk that the negative effects of, for example, quarantining a huge number of people can actually cause significant harm as well?
Yeah, because if you've got, say, an older person who's dependent on a group of people caring for them, and those people then eschew that care provision because they're worried about either infecting the older person or getting infected themselves by going out, getting shopping and so on, that other person's going to have a care problem. And that could have knock-on consequences. Things may be missed. That person may fall over and hurt themselves and not be able to get up, and they may go longer before someone comes and helps them. So there will almost certainly be consequences in that respect. And then there's the whole psychological aspect of this. If you talk to people who were on the boat at Diamond Princess in Yokohama, they were going stir crazy. I mean, it puts a whole new spin on the phrase cabin fever, I know, because you've got these people with coronavirus combined to barracks for 2 weeks. But they were finding it very tough indeed to be stuck in something resembling their wardrobe. Some of those cabins didn't even have a window for 2 weeks. And it sounds like a holiday, but believe me, talking to those people, they said it absolutely wasn't. And I think that's a very real prospect, that we're also going to get social isolation. You're going to get people with mental illness, for example, who rely on contact with other people to help them stay well and stay ahead of, say, addictive problems and things like that. It could have all kinds of far-reaching consequences. So we do have to be proportionate and sensible and not unleash the floodgates too quickly on these measures, because there is a danger then people get complacent. People don't want to comply anymore because they're bored, and then it comes roaring back. So that's what we want to try and avoid.
Chris Smith, thanks very much. Let's finish the show now by going back in time with a question for you, Emma, and this is from Megan.
Why did Neanderthals go extinct? Well, it's a tricky one, actually. It's something that we've been debating for decades, and I still don't think we have a clear answer. If we go back sort of a number of decades, it was assumed that Neanderthals were not as intelligent as modern humans. And so it's rather coincidental, perhaps, that Neanderthals go extinct just about the time that modern humans spread and become successful in Europe. So some people have argued, well, perhaps they just weren't as good as catching animals and they weren't as flexible in the kind of plants they could eat. However, the evidence that we're getting now is that that gap in sort of cognitive ability, so mental capacity, was not so great as we used to assume. We've got evidence for things like decoration of the body in Neanderthals, symbolic things that signal that higher level of intelligence. So other ideas that people have put forward, and these have been somewhat revolutionised actually by studies of genetics and ancient DNA, we can see that among the Neanderthals, especially those just before they go extinct around 40,000 years ago, their genetic diversity is really low. So we can look at Neanderthals from across their range and there's not much variation between them. And that's really important because we know that once species start to lose their genetic diversity, they become very susceptible both to inherited diseases but also infectious diseases. So it's possible that that loss of diversity could actually have led to their extinction.
What would that have come from, though?
That's sort of another tricky question.
Because you get that from inbreeding? That's the main one, correct?
Yes, exactly. Inbreeding. And what we think must have been happening was that their population levels were relatively low compared to modern humans. Now, why that is, again, is a difficult question to answer. It could be because perhaps their rate of reproduction and the rate of population growth was lower. Perhaps it's been suggested that as the climate fluctuated over sort of the centuries and millennia, their preferred habitats kind of became more common so the population could spread out. But then in the intervening periods, they got restricted to really small areas and many died out. So over time, that variability got less and less.
Is it possible that it was less passive aggression from us and more, you know, actual aggression?
Well, that's a possibility.
Because we're not the nicest.
We can be very compassionate and nice, but we can do nasty things to each other as well. And there are arguments that, you know, we were involved in extinction of Neanderthals, maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally. The evidence for an intentional involvement is pretty thin on the ground. We have one Neanderthal from a site called Chanadar Cave in Iraqi Kurdistan from around the time that Neanderthals were going extinct. And he has an injury to one of his ribs that comes from a projectile. So traditionally, those are associated with our own species, modern humans, as having that ability to make this more kind of advanced technology. So some people have said perhaps that's one example of modern humans killing off Neanderthals.
And the earliest episode of CSI, probably to date.
Well, it could be. Another less intentional way that we might have helped to kill off Neanderthals is actually through the spread of disease. So it's been suggested that modern humans, who we evolved in Africa and then we spread out into Europe where Neanderthals were, and probably what we brought with us was a whole load of new diseases that the Neanderthals had never encountered before. So they didn't have the evolved immunity to actually be able to fight off those diseases. Now, in some cases, you know, new diseases come or introduce and they spread, and they can be serious, like with coronavirus at the moment, but the rate of mortality is not necessarily huge. But we know of other examples. For example, when Europeans first went to the Americas and took with them smallpox, that had a devastating effect on the native populations there because they'd never been exposed. They had no immune response that had evolved and the genes that you need to be able to fight that off. So maybe we're seeing a similar scenario with Neanderthals and modern humans, especially if the Neanderthals were already rather inbred and perhaps lacking the genetic diversity that would have given them strong immunity.
Folks, we must leave it there. Thank you so much for listening and for sending in your questions. And thanks to our panel, Nadia Radsman, Chris Rogers, Emma Pomeroy and Chris Smith. Do join us next time when we're exploring the secrets behind sustainable cities of the future, from underground farms to a virtual version of the City of London. The Naked Scientist comes to you from Cambridge University and is supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm Phil Sansom, and until next time, goodbye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.